Kia ora, I'm Vincent Herringer and welcome to This Climate Business. Every week we talk to people turning the climate crisis into opportunity. Follow us on social media and please rate the show as it helps others to find us. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi, it's Vincent here. This week we heard the terrible news that a champion for climate action, Rod Oram, died of injuries sustained while doing what he loved, riding his bike in Auckland. Rod was a regular guest on this podcast and a personal friend. In the coming days, we'll be putting together a show remembering Rod, including highlights from previous interviews. And today, we'd just like to acknowledge his passing and offer condolences to his family, Lynn, Celeste and Kia, and to his many friends and admirers. Rod was fierce about the right things and endlessly gracious towards everyone, including his critics. His influence was felt across generations. Well, from truthiness to not truthiness, we're going to talk about disinformation. Whether it's swallowing bleach to treat COVID or casting climate change as a Chinese conspiracy, disinformation takes nutty ideas from the fringes and somehow mainstreams them into our popular discourse. At best, it's hilarious. Have you seen how windmills can kill dolphins? But mostly it's just sad and sometimes pretty tragic. What is disinformation? How is it different from misinformation? Who are the main perpetrators and who are the victims? Well, no one knows more about this than Byron Clark, author of Fear, New Zealand's Hostile Underworld of Extremists, and Mandy Henk, an advocate for healthy, just and vibrant digital communities. And together, they're offering a climate disinformation night class consisting of 8 weekly Zoom-based sessions via Toha Toha, an organisation creating a fairer digital world. Well, I think Rod would be very proud to support you both. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mandy, I feel like disinformation is kind of a new word, a new neologism. I've always wanted to say that word out loud. Is it new? How is it different from the older version, which is misinformation?
Actually, I think disinformation is the older version of that. It actually derives from Russian operations going back to the Cold War. So disinformation is a term that has been used often with propaganda, because propaganda is a core part of how disinformation works. Misinformation, I think, is actually the newer term. And misinformation is a sort of complicated idea, because in order for misinformation to exist, really disinformation has to exist. Oftentimes misinformation is talked about in terms of people being just organically wrong about things.
Right.
And people being wrong about things on the internet is definitely an enormous problem in our society. But the way that I conceptualize it is it's almost like a continuum. Information and narratives will enter the discourse as disinformation. And then once they begin organically spreading, that's when we talk about misinformation. So people can be spreading misinformation quite innocently without any ill intent, but the people who inserted those narratives into the discourse are the disinformation
right.
spreaders.
There's a maliciousness that runs through that, isn't there? That's quite different from being just plain mistaken or wrong.
I mean, exactly.
I believe I have been wrong in the past, and I will admit it. But I'm not maliciously so, but disinformation has this kind of underlying maliciousness to it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Disinformation is a tactic that is often used to sow chaos. It's often intended to create harm and division within a society. And so disinformation is something that is sort of done to a population by another, you know, either a state or a corporate actor with the intent of causing harm. People spread misinformation because they've just been duped and they're just genuinely wrong about something.
Yeah. You mentioned propaganda. Propaganda kind of, what does that take disinformation and apply it at a, what is it, sort of more organizational level or a state level or something?
So the definitions here are really interesting. I don't think we could say that there are sort of clear accepted academic definitions that cover both disinformation and misinformation and propaganda. These are very much contested spaces. And part of that contestation is How do you define propaganda? How do you define disinformation? For me, the definition that I prefer of propaganda is that propaganda will often have a power component to it.
Right, yeah.
And propaganda will often be something that is sort of the actual thing that is the disinformation, with disinformation being the tactic.
Right. Yeah, okay. Interesting. And so propagandic, it sounds kind of like, I don't know, organized crime. It sounds like a more deliberate and, as you say, sort of mixed with power structures. So it could be a state, it could be a corporation, it could be an organized entity that is using disinformation to a particular end, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think disinformation and propaganda are both highly organized these days. And I think essentially disinformation is the larger term, and I would put propaganda as sort of a subcategory
okay.
under that.
But a lot of it, and Byron, you would have come across this a lot of disinformation seems so preposterous. You know, it starts out just so ridiculous and is easy to dismiss because it is just so nutty. You know, I mentioned some of those things, you know, taking bleach for COVID, or you know, a horse pill for treating a human condition. That these things start on the fringes and just sound so dumb. Why are we taking this seriously? Why have you written a whole book about it, Byron?
Yeah, well, they may sound pretty ridiculous, but there's a lot of people out there who are believing these things. And I think even when some of these things aren't believed, a lot of the goal of the people spreading disinformation isn't necessarily to get people to believe their particular flavor of disinformation, but just to create this idea that there's a contested space. So we see that a lot in, you know, climate change, the topic we're going to be looking at. People will put out all this disinformation about, oh, the planet's been changing, the climate's been changing forever, it's not caused by humans, and we'll hear like, oh, actually it's cooling, and we'll hear all these different narratives that are not compatible with each other. But for somebody who's just, say, a casual listener to news media, like we look at some news media in the course that's spread a little bit of disinformation, perhaps unwittingly, or someone who, even worse, is getting all their news through social media, they might be exposed to all these different narratives and they don't know which one is true and which one is false.
Right. And so it doesn't, the kind of the silliness of it, or, you know, the unbelievably offness of it, in some ways doesn't really matter. It's just so long as it's creating a kind of sense of chaos. Is that the ambition behind the perpetrators?
Quite often, yeah. I mean, in some cases, there are very specific narratives that are being pushed. Like one case study we'll be looking at is around methane emissions, and that was a big one here because unlike most industrialized countries, most of New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions are, well, not quite most, but just under half of our greenhouse gas emissions are methane rather than carbon dioxide. And a lot of that is from livestock, which means we've got a large industry here that has a political interest in perhaps not paying for their emissions or reducing their emissions. So we saw a lot of disinformation about methane specifically. But that goes into a media landscape where people are hearing this disinformation about methane, and then they're hearing wider disinformation about whether climate change is even happening, or perhaps they're hearing some of the more out there conspiracy theories that it's some sort of conspiracy being driven by the UN, and they're getting all of this, and yeah, and it's very difficult to know what is accurate and what is not, and certainly what we're seeing in like the methane disinformation campaign sounds more plausible than believing that the UN is creating this hoax in order to bring about global government, which I think very few people actually leap on that, but they might hear that a scientist is touring the country saying that methane's an irrelevant greenhouse gas. That was the title of the speaking tour, and they might think, oh, okay, well, if a scientist is saying that, and they might not really look into it deeply because realistically we don't go and fact-check every little bit of information that we hear.
Yeah.
So we're exposed to so much of it.
What makes that particular one more powerful is there is a kind of a cloak of credibility around a scientist, you know, talking about sciencey sounding things, right? So there's a truthiness about disinformation that makes it kind of sticky. Is that what and the best kind of disinformation is very closely aligned to factual information, right?
Yeah, I think by and large, what you're going to find with these sorts of narratives is that there will be some sort of truthiness, some kernel of something that is true. Often what you'll see is framing around it, and that framing is actually where the sort of inaccuracies and untruth of it falls. But often that framing will be aligned with people's pre-existing identities and beliefs. The way that people approach searching for information, the way that people approach believing information has a lot more to do with what their identities are and who they see themselves to be than with what might actually be true. So the question of who they trust, why they trust that person, all of those things come into play when people choose to believe something like that the UN has some sort of hoax to take over the world, for example, using global warming as some sort of entree into that. So the fact that there is actually maybe a lot of facts embedded in that doesn't really make it not disinformation, because the disinformation is embedded within the larger narrative. Okay.
Well, let's specifically look at that methane example. So it is true that there are methane is has a different effect on the atmosphere than carbon dioxide, and so there is legitimate space there to discuss what is the role of these two different gases. One is a short-lived gas, one is a long-lived gas, obviously more powerful. Also, methane doesn't accumulate. It breaks down over time, over a relatively short period, 5 years, I understand. And so there's interesting debate there to be had around the facts of the role that methane plays in climate change. Byron, where does the line start and fall between factually, accurately, scientifically talking about the role of methane and its difference from carbon dioxide and disinformation and a deliberate kind of skewing towards an agenda? Can you describe that line?
So, yeah, like you say, it does behave differently in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. And a lot of people perhaps will think, oh, it's only going to be in the atmosphere for 5 years. Why does it matter? And then they might hear that it is irrelevant, and you start looking into it, and it's not irrelevant. We measure these greenhouse gases in terms of their like equivalency to carbon, and that's where methane is a bit of a problem here. But if you've got a supposedly credible voice telling you that it's irrelevant, they can mix in a bit of that true information, like the short-lived nature of the gas, with you know, some false information. So the scientist who toured a number of South Island locales in a tour organized by Groundswell, so he would mix in, he did a few radio interviews on both on mainstream media like ZB and on more fringe platforms like Reality Check Radio, and he would sort of mix in a little bit of science, a little bit of dubious science, and, you know, and a fair chunk of like political opinion as well. So, you know, it suggests that there's some sort of agenda going on. He's pretty vague. He doesn't have this big conspiracy narrative that that I've seen some people have. But if somebody's also being exposed to those kind of narratives about the UN or about the World Economic Forum or whoever, and then they're listening to a, you know, supposedly credible scientific voice who also hints at some kind of political agenda, that's when they're going to start perhaps misunderstanding exactly what's going on there.
Mm. Why does it matter? You know, there's I hate to bring in the kind of the tropes around free speech and stuff, but just to explain for me, why does it matter that someone is on the fringe and is spreading information or encouraging people to have thoughts that are kind of outside the accepted mainstream of science? You know, and I'm thinking particularly of you, Byron, because you've just been through, you know, quite a challenging part of your life covering these extremist movements. And I guess, you know, I'm interested in your personal experience about what are the implications for you, and yeah, what, you know, what does it, what did it matter for you, but why did it matter for the country?
Well, those fringe movements, while they are on the fringe, they're not insignificant in terms of the impact that they have on our politics. So in the case of this methane disinformation campaign, Groundswell, after doing this tour, they spent about $140,000 to influence the outcome of the election. They did this mostly through advertising on social media. And some of the ads were about rural issues, including methane, but most of them were not. They were just general ads about changing the government. And each ad ended with Labor is the problem. And they weren't endorsing a particular political party, but through the coalition agreement that's been signed between National and ACT, there is a promise there to review the methane science and targets in 2024 for consistency with no additional warming from agricultural methane emissions. Mm. So when that review happens, what will likely be found is that there is a connection between agricultural emissions and additional warming. But this is likely going to delay the time that we have to reduce our methane emissions on farms. And I think we're getting to a point with climate change where any delay is a very bad thing. Mm. So while a group like Groundswell is quite fringe, and some of the speakers they're promoting perhaps more fringe still, they do have that impact there. And the same is true of some of these other groups that I've followed when writing my book. Like another thing we've seen in the coalition agreement, not the National and ACT one, but the National and New Zealand First one, is things like changing rules around sporting participation for people who are transgender and things like that are quite fringe issues. But these fringe groups have been able to get a bit of a foothold in some of our smaller political parties and then turn their little fringe pet projects into actual government policy.
Mm, okay, interesting. I can see that Mandy is bouncing to say something about the implications for climate change.
Well, I was going to say, so when we think about those sorts of questions around free speech and around what is and isn't disinformation, the way that academics generally will sort of classify and think about that is using taxonomies. There's a really good taxonomy created by Cohn et al. That covers climate change disinformation, but it has some really significant limitations. So a lot of what we're working on doing is taking sort of a 10,000-foot discourse view, so that you can sort of examine the various parts of the discourse within sort of the movements for climate action. And that gives you a much better understanding of identifying people's vulnerabilities to disinformation, as well as disinformation narratives that would otherwise go unrecognized because they aren't necessarily coming from these fringe actors. So mm-hmm. I would actually argue that there is enormous amounts of climate disinformation, probably the bulk of it, doesn't actually come from these sorts of fringe groups that have been responsible as of late for our troubles. I think we're looking at the fossil fuel industry, and we're looking at other sorts of industries that benefit and states that benefit very heavily from the production of fossil fuels. So in that sense, the climate discourse and climate disinformation discourse is sort of like if you did a Venn diagram, you sort of have climate discourse and climate disinformation over here, and you have an intersection with a lot of these far-right groups, but they're not actually the same. And to look at climate, you really need to sort of examine the various discourses within it to identify where vulnerabilities to disinformation exist. Mm.
And these organizations that are extremely well-funded, highly intelligent, well-researched, have identified those vulnerabilities, that's what you're saying, right, and are able to exploit them quite successfully.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, depending on sort of where you stand within the climate movement, that's going to determine what kind of disinformation you might be vulnerable to. The other thing that's very true about climate disinformation is that for a very long time, we thought of climate disinformation largely as denialism. So it would be, global warming isn't caused by humans, or the temperature isn't rising. And the fact is, since about 2008, we have really good empirical evidence that the actual sort of area of disinformation and denialism within climate is largely about climate policy. Mm-hmm. So in order for us to have these conversations in a way that is authentic and not being manipulated by outside actors who have disinformation campaigns going, it's actually really important that we understand where these lines are between what is a sort of reasonable position that we're going to allow into the discourse, and what is a position that is in fact a disinformation narrative pretending to be a reasonable policy position.
That's quite a subjective line that you've just described, isn't it? What are your tools for discerning where that line exists?
So my main tool is not doing it for myself, actually, or doing it for myself but not doing it for other people. So a lot of what the work that I do and a lot of sort of what we teach is actually understanding the climate discourse as a whole. So we actually have a framework that we use in order to sort of divide the discourse into six different parts. And each part of that discourse has particular vulnerabilities. So what we aim to do is to teach people to recognize where their vulnerabilities are, depending on where they fall within that climate conversation. And as much as possible, with one really important notable exception, keeping that sort of framework as normatively neutral as possible, right? Like, these are a range of acceptable positions, and the fact that you might be a techno-optimist and I might be in favor of climate justice means that we have different vulnerabilities to disinformation, mm-hmm. but it doesn't necessarily negate either of our positions, right? We can both come to this conversation with legitimate positions.
Yeah, just expand on that. Give me some really specific examples. What do you mean by a vulnerability?
So one of the things that I think is a fairly well-known controversial area within climate conversations is geoengineering. So we've been talking a lot lately about what's called solar radiation management, if you've been paying attention to mm-hmm. climate discourse. And I think it's a very reasonable question as to what extent is the material put out by the group Make Sunsets, right? To what extent is that propaganda and disinformation? Or to what extent is that going to be welcomed as a valid contribution to the conversation? So rather than doing the sort of work of labeling something disinformation or not, it makes a lot of sense to sort of talk to techno-optimists and be like, hey, here are some things that you need to consider when looking at that, because this is going to be something that you're going to be less likely to examine critically because it already agrees with your worldview. Mm-hmm. So helping people to identify what their own biases are and then helping people to bring hopefully some improved information literacy skills to that is, I think, a really key part of how we create a resilient climate movement. So one of the things that I have seen happening within the climate movement is there is a lot of declaring folks the new deniers, right? Doomers have been declared the new deniers. As of late, mainstream climate scientists have been declared the new deniers. And a lot of what I would like to see is people stop doing that, actually. In order for us to recognize disinformation when we encounter it and to identify our information vulnerabilities, we need to have some much better definitional sort of work around who is and isn't a denier, or else we're just going to shout at each other and call each other deniers all the time.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem very productive.
Well, labeling is a really unhelpful way to conduct a conversation, isn't it? And Byron, I'm kind of interested in your point of view on this too. Less so sort of in the climate space, but in your experience of covering you know, these, I suppose you'd call them right-wing angry men movement. I don't
mostly,
know.
Mostly.
Oh, there I am putting some labels on it.
A few women, but mostly men, disproportionately.
Yeah. When you do engage in dialogue, how do you get beyond a label and actually have a decent conversation? And what happens when you do break through?
Well, it can be quite hard to break through. And one of the questions I get a lot when I'm, you know, speaking in an event is, you know, how do I talk to my colleague or my family member or my friend who's gone down this rabbit hole? And I always tell people that, well, the first thing is it's good that it's you talking to them, because what people are going to believe is less about the accuracy of the information they're getting and more about the relationship what they have with the person who's giving them that information. Mm. And a lot of the disinformation online is come about through what are called parasocial relationships, where people feel like this YouTube personality or this podcaster is not just somebody in the media, but that they're actually like a personal friend. And you can see that with some of the language that gets used on these YouTube channels or podcasts, like where the host will say, like, know, they're trying to take away your freedom and our freedom, and they'll foster this kind of parasocial relationship. So if you've got an actual relationship with someone, you've got a much better chance of convincing them of correct information than if you were to just point them in the direction of somebody who is, sharing the accurate science, but maybe not communicating in the same manner as these disinformation promoters online. In the few occasions where I've spoken to someone myself, which does happen, sometimes these people will come along to events and they'll keep quiet and grab me after the official question time, and probably not going to convince someone in a situation like that. Just in a one-off, you're not going to undo that whole media ecosystem that they're in just with one in-person conversation. But nonetheless, I try and try and listen, try and find commonalities in there. For example, I had someone say, well, don't you think there should be an investigation into how the government handled COVID? And I said, well, yeah, I welcome that. I think it would be really good to have an investigation into how the government handled COVID so that we could be more prepared for next time there's a pandemic or next time there's some other crisis that we have to deal with. I think it would be really useful. And then when they start to perhaps see that people like myself aren't just wanting to lock us all down in our houses, which obviously was a big part of the pandemic, but it's also something people are saying now about climate change. They're claiming there's going to be climate lockdowns, we're going to be locked in our 15-minute cities and that sort of thing. So when people can understand that, we're not actually advocating all these silly things that progressives or climate change activists are accused of wanting, then I think that kind of maybe plants some seeds there that might grow and get people thinking a little more critically about the other information they're consuming.
There's you're sort of hinting at also kind of a warmth of human connection, and I talked about Rod Oram at the top of the show, and Rod was remarkable for playing the ball, not the man. He always met people where they were and was able to dialogue with warmth and humanity. And I think that's what's made him such an effective communicator. And even his critics, he managed to enjoy their company and they respected him and his views. And I think that ability to connect at a human level must be kind of part of our mission as climate activists, to bring people with us.
Yeah, I think that being able to connect at a human level is really important. I think it's also worth noting, though, that not everyone is able to do that as easily. Both Rod and certainly Byron have the advantage of being white men, and it is substantially easier for white men to have these conversations. Mm. I have also had the opportunity to talk with folks, and the level of misogyny that I often face is extremely, extremely challenging. So I do think that the human connection is incredibly important, but I think that maybe we don't all have the same obligations in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Nicely put. I think something I'd want to pick up on that is a little bit related to that, but extends it a bit into the political dialogue. You mentioned that we have these vulnerabilities or biases there, or maybe kind of interests. And I remember reading about different ways of talking about climate to different groups. And for this was American research, but for conservatives, issues around sovereignty and security were much more important. For other groups, it was around fairness and equity. For others, it was about environment. Is part of our success in communicating climate action identifying those areas of interest and exploring those with people? So, for instance, if you're talking with someone who is inclined towards being worried about security, is that a really good place to start the dialogue with someone?
Maybe yes and maybe no. I mean, I think one of the things that we have to recognize is there was a study out recently, 85% of people understand and believe that climate change is happening and is caused by humans. So that sort of parallels with what the data on climate disinformation says, which is that we're having policy conversations now So I do think it's important to meet people where you are as much as possible. But I think it's also the case that we've moved past trying to convince people it's real. And now we're having substantive policy conversations.
Yeah.
And once we get into substantive policy conversations, things are going to be much trickier because you're going to run into values, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if we're looking at immigration, which is absolutely a climate issue, global migration is one of the most acute and urgent climate impacts that we're going to and are experiencing.
Mm.
And there is a very wide range of views and opinions on how migration should be had. So, like, very, very glad that we're going to be having conversations about immigration rather than is climate change real. But also, I think people need to be very much committed to their values and very much committed to standing by their values, because there is going to be an enormous effort made to push things through under urgency that probably don't need to be pushed through under urgency,
mm-hmm.
And to pursue what are, in fact, even though they might not be named as such, climate solutions that will do an enormous amount of harm to the most vulnerable among us.
Interesting. Tell me about the night class. What are you hoping will be the outcome, and who is it for?
Absolutely. So the Climate Disinformation Night School is something that derived from a program that we did called A Bit Sus, which had the same sort of structure where it would be, you know, we would release a lecture and then we'd all get together and talk for about an hour, hour and a half, and do fun activities. We did that with the librarians from SLANTA, the school librarians organization, and it went really, really well. And a lot of what we focused on with A Bit Sus was teaching how to teach and how to do countered misinformation interventions. So not only did we teach sort of about the theory of sort of understanding what is mis and disinformation, but also things like how to do and how to teach lateral reading, how to do and how to teach pre-bunking, and how social norm theory applies to our information behavior. So in terms of dis and misinformation, there are a range of evidence-based interventions that people can implement.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on sort of where you are and who you are, there are things you can do yourself, or there are things that you can do on a larger scale in the way that you communicate with others. So a lot of what we'll be teaching is understanding climate disinformation, which has a long and interesting history and a really interesting role that it's playing right now in terms of stopping climate action, but also looking at how to apply those known evidence-based interventions to the climate discourse and to the work that people are doing. So it's really for anyone who's interested in these, anyone in the climate movement who wants a better understanding of how to make sure that the comms that they're doing and any campaigns that they might be running can be as much as possible made resilient against
mm-hmm.
these sorts of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we're incredibly excited about it. We're hoping at least that we're going to manage to pull off an interesting combination of sort of theory and sort of deep understanding around these sorts of issues, but also really practical things. So one of the outcomes that we're hoping for is that people will create a counter-climate disinformation plan that they can implement within their own sort of context, whatever that might be.
Mm, interesting. What's your role going to be at Byron?
Mm. Well, I'm running the lecture for the second class, and we're looking specifically at that methane disinformation campaign. But we're not just going to be sort of debunking the misinformation and disinformation that's out there. We're also going to be looking at doing a bit of discourse analysis on some of that disinformation. So we're going to look at like transcripts of these radio interviews, some of the advertisements put out, some of the press releases and things, and now learn to interpret some of that stuff. So, like I said earlier, we're not fact checking every bit of information that crosses in front of our eyes, because we're just seeing so much of it. But if people can get some of those skills, so that when they are listening to an interview on the radio, or if they are reading an article, and they can start thinking like about, you know, what are the meanings of some of these phrases that are used,
mm-hmm.
and some of these terms that are used, mm-hmm. and then just think a bit more critically about the information that we're getting, and that's a skill I'd really like people to go away from this course with, to have that increased media literacy and some critical thinking there around the information they're consuming.
Well, let's try and do a really cheeky fast track lesson. What are one or two key kind of skills that we need to develop to spot disinformation at a distance?
I think that one of the most important things that people develop is an idea that was developed by the Stanford History Education Group. It's part of the larger idea of lateral reading, and it's called click restraint.
Say that slowly.
Click restraint. So the idea is that when you encounter new pieces of information, when you see something, particularly something that causes you to have a strong emotional reaction, either pro or anti, if you're not familiar with where it came from, if you're not familiar with the sort of larger discourse that it's occurring within particularly, don't click on it. Just don't click on it. Rather than doing that, open up a new browser tab, do some searching, and find some sources that you trust, and see what sources that you trust and that you have confidence in already say about this, rather than giving your, you know, very, very precious time to what could be absolute nonsense.
And that's because we haven't actually really touched on the role that social media platforms have done in amplifying this. That's actually a big gap. We should probably just mention that now. But click restraint really addresses the power of the algorithms to drive people down directions and into rabbit holes and into sort of the rage machine, right?
Possibly. The evidence on that is a little bit mixed these days. I think that there was stronger evidence, particularly.
Oh, well, I believe that. I don't need more facts to prove me wrong. Thank you very much, Mandy.
Particularly for YouTube's algorithm. I think that is very much still a problem, particularly with Facebook's algorithm. But I also think that, which is in no way whatsoever to let the platforms off the hook for what they should be doing to make the internet safer. But I think a lot of that rabbit holing comes from the human way in which we approach information and the way in which we gather together with other people who share our beliefs and seek those people out, which isn't to say that we shouldn't do everything that we can to make the internet as safe as possible and avoid those rabbit holes. But I also think that a lot of that is just people being people and doing what people do.
I met the guy, by the way, who created the endless scroll. He was working in social media in Silicon Valley, and he was the guy that developed the endless scroll. And he said that he regrets it now. He goes around the world talking about how he developed basically crack cocaine on social media. Kind of interesting aside. Anyway, click restraint, like it. Good tip. How about you, Byron? What should we do to be more careful of our reliance on quality and not misinformation and disinformation?
So I think just a few basic things would be thinking about some of the terms and words that you hear during an interview or while you're reading something. So emotive language could be one. Like if someone is saying climate alarmists, start thinking, well, why are they saying climate alarmists? That doesn't sound like it's not something you'd read in a scientific paper about climate change. Or if they are saying something that is aiming to discredit other sources. So give an example that we'll use in the course. Someone being interviewed and claiming that the media is captured by the other side of the argument. You know, we hear something like that and think about why they might say that. What do they mean by that? Is that accurate? Things like that. Really take in the information and think about phrases and words and what the deeper meaning could be behind what you're hearing, rather than just having a surface level understanding of it, which is how we end up believing a lot of misinformation. And you know, I'm as guilty as anyone, because a lot of the media I consume will be listening to the radio while I'm tidying the house or whatever, and I'm not thinking that deeply about it. And if I'm listening to a quality source, that's maybe not a big issue. But if you are listening to something that perhaps is giving a platform to some of these disinformation spreaders, then we are going to have a problem there.
Yeah, okay, great advice. How do we find information online about the course?
Oh, so you can go online to our website. It's www.com. tohatoha.org/cdns. Great. Or you can also just go to our webpage. You can click from there.
Okay, fantastic. When does it start, by the way?
The 4th of April, actually. So if people could go ahead and get registered, that would be amazing. We have a cost for it, but we also have sponsors lined up. So if people are keen for it, but they don't have enough money for it or they don't have any money, it's fine to go ahead and register. And we will hopefully have enough sponsors to allow everyone on the wait list in, regardless of ability to
Fantastic.
Pay.
Fantastic. Well, the cost is pretty cost effective. I think $400 for 8 classes from 2 experts. So thank you, Mandy, Byron, for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for listening to This Climate Business. If you like the show, please rate us as it helps others to find us. Ka kite anō.